Good morning. It's 10:15, time to get started. This is my last session, finally. For those of you who have attended all of my sessions so far this week, thanks. Hopefully this one will be okay. I do have to warn you in advance that there'll be lots of PowerPoint slides with lots of information on it. This is going to end up being more kind of the reference deck that you would want to use for future troubleshooting exercises, with a few demos thrown in just to kind of show you what it means to look at these log files. What do these log files look like to do some common troubleshooting steps? So as we go through, we had to figure out how many different ways can things break, and then how to troubleshoot all of those different ways. And unfortunately, that means that there's a lot of potential ways that you'll have to troubleshoot. The deployment process itself consists of lots of parts. Each of those parts has the potential for breaking, some of them more than others. There are lots of moving parts, so we had to be able to figure out which one failed, why did it fail, and what can we do about it. We want to spend a little bit of time on kind of each layer of the stack. If you're using MDT, if you're using Config Manager, we'll spend some time on each one of those. We'll also talk some about the underlying tools from the Windows AIK or the Windows ADK, things like USMT and ImageX and those pieces. And also get into Pixie and WDS and a few other things as well. If you're using another solution or have built your own solution, you'll still probably be using some pieces out of this and could still be running into the same issues. So the same tips should apply, although there'll be plenty of logs that are MDT specific or Config Manager specific that you wouldn't necessarily care about. But we'll try to touch on all of them, and hopefully you can pick up something that's useful out of that. So to start off with, these are the typical errors that most people would see. And you will look at these and say, none of those are useful, because all they really tell you is something went wrong. They don't tell you what went wrong. So if you look at the salmon-colored screen, that's just MDT light touch saying an error occurred in the task sequence. Screen next to it is a Config Manager task sequence failure. Again, not useful. It's just showing you the typical error number -214746-7259, which only means an error has occurred. We already knew that. The black screen in the middle is the result of a blue screen. You don't necessarily know why the blue screen happened, because with Windows 7 and above, the default isn't to stay on the blue screen screen. So it flashes up and immediately reboots. And you see this. So that's the symptom. That's not the problem. The problem is, well, what caused the blue screen in the first place? So now we had to get into troubleshooting each one of those and see, well, what really happened to cause all of those errors? And that means lots and lots of logs. So just some general tips. For best results, you need to know what the logs for a successful deployment typically look like. So don't assume that you're going to be able to pick up a log from the first failure you encounter, having never looked at one of these logs, and be able to figure out what's normal and what isn't. We've tried our best in MDT to make sure that we didn't log anything that looks like an error, that isn't an error, that is a normal occurrence. But some of the other logs that we'll be talking about aren't quite so friendly. They will log errors that are normal. If you stop scanning a log with the first error line that you find, you're going to go off on so many different tangents only to find out, oh, that was just a false alarm. That wasn't the issue anyway. We'll talk about a few of those and give you a real example of how you can be kind of taken down the wrong path just by assuming the log is telling you something useful when it probably isn't. You also, in a lot of cases, will need to pay as much attention to what isn't in the logs. We've tried to improve that over time, but the challenge that we've run into is you could be going through a process and get to a point where there's an unexpected failure. So you will see the failure, but you don't necessarily know exactly where it happened. So now you had to look at, well, what was the immediate, What was the last entry logged successfully, and what happens right after that? For example, maybe we're installing an application and the last entry says starting this command line, and then you see nothing after that. Well, it probably then has something to do with the command line that was just launched. So you kind of had to infer that the problem was caused by the last command that was issued, even if there's not a specific entry in the log that says that's what caused the issue. We've tried to add more and more entries over time to say that we're about to do something, and then afterwards we'll say that we've successfully done something, just so that you can see before and after, because if something happens in the middle, you wouldn't necessarily know about it. So it's not perfect, but we're getting better. It's also useful to know how to get an error message out of an error number. So if you don't know how to do that, we'll take a look at how to do that, but there's a gotcha on that. Don't assume that the error message that you get from an error number actually is the error that you got. Sometimes it's useful, sometimes it isn't. We'll take a look at an example where it could be useful and another example where it might not be as we go through here. There are some utilities that will help you with viewing these logs. There's a Trace32 utility that's part of the Config Manager 2007 toolkit, which you can download from the Download Center. There's also a newer version of that in Config Manager 2012 called CM Trace. The big limitation with Trace32 in the past was there was only a 32-bit version of it. People liked putting this into their boot images so that they could browse logs while they were in Windows PE. That worked great for x86. That didn't work so well for x64 boot images because there was no trace64.exe. At least there wasn't supposed to be one. Now with the CM Trace utility, you get 32-bit and 64-bit versions of that, so we'll look at how to get those and how those actually work. There were some challenges in Trace 32. I'm not sure if they're still in CM Trace. I haven't tried that recently, but some logs will end up with binary zeros in them, and as soon as the Trace viewer finds a binary zero, it stops displaying any more information. That was especially problematic with MSI installation files. In those cases, you would just see the first maybe 100 lines, and you wouldn't even know that there was another 5,000 lines after that. In those cases, Notepad's your friend. Notepad doesn't care about embedded binary zeros. It will show you the whole file regardless of what's in it. So, can you ever have too many logs? No. Grab logs from anywhere you can find them. Anytime you run into a problem, even if you don't think the log's going to be useful, still grab a copy. Because odds are you're going to find at some point, oh, I need a different log to figure out what the next step is. If I don't have that one, now I had to recreate the problem. Some problems are very easy to recreate. Other problems are a real pain to recreate. So grab all the logs, zip them up, put them in a folder, whatever you want to do with them. Odds are if you send an email out to us or talk to Microsoft support or submit something to the TechNet forums asking a question, the first reply back is going to be, can you post your logs? So if you have them already, that will help out quite a bit. So we need to talk about each of the tools and the logs that they create. So we're going to try to go through this as quickly as possible because otherwise we're going to end up spending the entire day talking about log files. So let's first talk about when we're using MDT. You can tell MDT that you want to copy all the logs to a share at the end of the process. There's a couple of task sequence variables that you can set for that. There's one called SL share. If you set that to a UNC path, we'll automatically copy all the interesting logs into a folder named with the computer name for each deployment that you do. There's another one called SL share dynamic logging, which will do it a little more dynamically. It'll actually write each log entry from bdd.log to the server in real time. That means that every line it writes locally to bdd.log also gets written to the server into a server-side log as well. That's great in lab environments where you want to watch the deployment go along. I wouldn't necessarily suggest that in a production deployment when you have lots of machines all across the world doing these deployments. because that causes a lot of network traffic. Those logs aren't small, and the process of opening them, writing another log entry to it, and then closing it again causes a fair amount of network traffic. But in the lab, works pretty well. So let's talk about log files. First, for Windows. The operating system installation process creates two primary files. Setup.act.log has all the details from the install process. Setup.error.log is an extraction from setup.act.log that shows only the error messages that were logged in the first file. It may show you messages that were logged as errors because Windows Setup says they're errors, but they didn't actually cause a failure. It's not unusual for setup.error.log to contain entries in a completely successful deployment. So they're non-fatal errors. It keeps on going. These files tend to move around, and there can be multiple copies of them. So grab them all. But depending on where the failure is in the process, they could be in the $Windows-BT-sources-panther folder. That would mean that we've initiated setup, it's running inside of a full OS, and the setup process failed very early. They could be in $Windows-BT-sources-panther. Same basic scenario, failed very early as we were installing the OS, and we were still in Windows PE at that point. Windows Panther is where the specialized logs end up getting created. So in this case, we've applied the operating system. It's booting up for the first time. It's going through the specialization process, the reversing of the sysprep. And in that case, those log files would be most interesting. After that process finishes, it initiates the UBI phase of the installation. The UBI logs get written into the Windows Panther unattendGC directory. And then when you're running sysprep, when sysprep executes, it actually writes its logs to see Windows System 32 sysprep panther. But again, they're always going to be named setup.act.log and setup.error.log. So in a typical deployment, you will probably want the panther logs and the panther unattendGC logs. Depending on what the failure is, you might look at the panther logs and see that they're newer than the unattendGC logs. That would give you a clue that the failure occurred before it got to UBI, because the UBI logs are older, which probably means they're from when the image was created instead of from the deployment that you're currently going through. So you have to use some intelligence sometimes to say, I know this set should get written first, then this set should be written. If this one's older, then it hasn't been written yet. There is a KB article, 927521, that describes what these log files are, what their purpose is, but they're not overly helpful in helping you decipher what's inside of them. There are then some additional logs that you may need to look at in specialized situations. There's a CBS.log, which is responsible for logging information about offline servicing, online servicing, patching, driver injection, those types of things. So when you have issues with those, CBS.log is going to be somewhat useful. Setup.api.dev.log is the log for plug and play. So anytime you have plug and play driver installation problems, you can look at that file. Netsetup.log is for domain join issues. So anytime you have a failed domain join, you can look in there and see what's going on. Windows update.log is useful when we're running a Windows update step in a task sequence, when you're using WSUS, when you're using a config manager update package, using the config manager SUP. All of those will end up writing information to the Windows update log. As far as difficulty in reading them goes, all of those are difficult to read. So you have to hope that when you get into these, you're looking for something very specific. You may not be able to decipher a lot of the garbage that ends up in those. I especially dislike the first one because it's really hard to figure out what's going on in thousands of lines of entries when you're really looking for one line that may or may not really show that there was an error that occurred. Plug and play is a little easier. Net setup is a little easier. Windows update is a little easier. They're really just trying to get you to understand what was happening at the time of the error. For Windows PE, then, There are only really two logs that are of interest there. WPE init.log exists on X Windows System 32. That logs information about the Windows PE boot up process. So as it installs drivers, as it injects the optional components that you've specified in your Windows PE boot image, things like HTA and ADO and that kind of thing, and as it runs commands, for example, the Light Touch Wizard, the information about those is logged into that file with timestamps. So this file, the X drive, is a RAM disk. So as soon as Windows PE reboots, this one disappears. So if there's anything that you ever need out of this log file, you need to grab it before the machine reboots. This is one of those cases where if you press F8 in Config Manager or in MDT, it'll pop up a command prompt. While that command prompt's open, Windows PE won't reboot. So that gives you the opportunity to look at this file, to grab a copy of the file, and use it later on. There's generally only one thing I look for in this particular log file. What took so long? So if Windows PE boots up, you see the background show up, and it sits there for longer than, say, 30 seconds with nothing happening, there's probably a driver that's being injected that isn't injecting properly, and that log file would be able to tell you what driver it was injecting at that time, and hopefully you could then figure out, do I have a bad driver? Maybe I can remove that one from my boot image, find a newer version of it, see if that eliminates the delays that are occurring during the initialization process. Otherwise, that log doesn't generally get very useful. There are some other scenarios where you would see errors in it, but there are types of issues that won't be obvious from looking at it. An example would be one of the things our testers seem to run into all the time. They'll create a virtual machine with 512 meg of RAM, which isn't quite enough to install, say, Windows 7 x64. The boot image takes up a significant amount of that. When you add in the optional components, add in extra drivers into the RAM disk, and then try to run, say, an offline servicing operation, random things start to fail because there isn't enough memory. So you'll see errors like that in the WPE init.log, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to make the leap from that error means I didn't have enough RAM. So just expect that you need to have more than 512 meg of RAM. That one used to catch us quite a bit where we would look at this forever and say, I just don't understand why this failure is occurring. Now the first thing that we do is when we see random errors that don't make sense, look at the BDD.log and see how much RAM did this machine have. If it had 512, ask them to try again with more RAM. Most of you are going to be doing deployments, hopefully with machines that have at least 1 gig of RAM, because that's more or less the absolute minimum needed to do OS deployment using MDT, using Config Manager. It is possible with, say, 600 to 700, but how many machines out there have any value in between 512 meg and 1 gig. So effectively, 1 gig is a good number to start with. Windows PE also logs to the setupapi.dev.log if you're trying to do any detailed plug-and-play injection, plug-and-play installation issues, but I think in the last 5 years I've looked at that log file twice. And it's just generally not going to show you much of use. The only drivers that you're really installing inside of Windows PE are network drivers and storage drivers. The initialization, the installation of those is actually kicked off by WPE init, so the information in WPE init is easier to follow than what's in the setupapi.log. Windows Deployment Services, if you're using Pixie, you may want to enable the WDS log. It's not turned on by default. It can be useful. There is a KB article 936625 that describes how to set the registry to tell WDS to create that. Once it creates it, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So eventually, stop the service, delete the file, and let it start creating a new one. Otherwise, you'll eventually run out of disk space. But it can be useful for troubleshooting Pixie requests because it'll log an entry every time it sees a packet from a client. and it'll log what its response back to that client was. So WDS and Pixie troubleshooting step number one with this log turned on. When you boot up a machine and you attempt to Pixie boot it by pressing F12, if you don't see any new entries written to this log file, doesn't matter what's going on the server, your Pixie packet's not getting to the server. So start with your networking people. Don't start with what's going on the server side. The packet has to get to the server before the server can actually respond, and this will tell you, without using a network trace program, did the packet get to the server? If you see an entry for the machine in the log, that doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot beyond, okay, the packet got there, but at least lets you focus on now what's going on server side instead of what's going on in the network. User state migration tool writes out a few logs itself. The names of those logs are actually configurable because you can specify them on command lines. The names that are used in MDT are on the left-hand side. The USMT estimate, USMT capture, USMT restore logs are the names that MDT uses. ScanState.log, LoadState.log are the default names that Config Manager uses. So those will be useful in cases where you see USMT has failed. Generally, the messages that you would see are something like ScanState.exe failed with return code equals 27. That doesn't tell you anything by itself. You have to go to the detailed scanstate.log to see, well, what caused this error 27? The task sequencer writes a log called smsts.log. This one is key to logging each step in the task sequence. What command line was executed? What did it return? What variables were passed to it? What conditions were evaluated to decide whether or not to run that step? So this one's key. It's not the easiest one to look through because it gets a little verbose, but the biggest challenge with it is it moves all over the place. So it may be in temp SMSTS log. That's where it'll be in Windows PE. It might be in Winder System 32 CCM logs. That would be if you're in CMO7 and have a client installed on a 32-bit OS. It might be in Winder SysWow 64 CCM logs. That would be Config Manager 2007, 32-bit client installed on a 64-bit server. It might be in Winder CCM. That would be Config Manager 2012. It might be in underscore SMS task sequence logs for a period of time in an OS install task sequence with Config Manager before the client's been installed. It might be in the SMSTS log folder. It might be on the X drive. It might be on the C drive. It just moves all over the place. So as a result, search everywhere for this thing. Grab every SMSTS asterisk.log file that you can find because you never quite know which one you're going to need. The entries for the error might not be in the current location, might be in a previous location. These logs will only get so big before it renames them to put a date time at the end of the file name and then starts writing to a new one. So grab anything that starts with SMSTS and then ends with .log. An example of where you can get a little challenged by that is if you look at an MDT task sequence in Config Manager. We basically have it set up as the task sequence and then an error handling group. So it's kind of like, if you're familiar with programming terms, it's a big try-catch block. It tries to run the entire task sequence, and if an error occurs, it falls into this catch group. And this goes through and downloads some files and runs some scripts and copies off logs. It does enough activity that it will fill up the smsts.log with error recovery information, which means the original error is now in the older archived file. So if you go to the end of the current log and start working your way back, you'd never get to the error because it's in a different log file. So grab them all, start looking through them, pay attention to the timestamps, try to correlate the times to figure out, okay, this log file covers the first 15 minutes, this log file covers the next 10, this one covers the last 2, piece it together and try to follow the logs then. In the case of MDT, each script that we run creates its own log in whatever location is current. In the case of LightTouch, it's always going to use MiniNT SMS OSD logs. That will be on X when we're in Windows PE for a new computer deployment before we formatted and partitioned the disk. After we format and partition the disk, or in any refresh case, it's going to be C MiniNT SMS OSD OSD logs. In the case of config manager deployments, you could find the logs in the underscore SMS task sequence folder. And in the end, at the end of a deployment, when we clean up, we'll put all of the logs in the Windows temp deployment logs folder. So if you ever want to look at them later, so you do a light touch deployment, it finishes or fails or whatever, and you click finish on the dialog and wonder where the logs went, they all got moved into the Windows temp deployment logs folder. There's also the bdd.log, which is the summarized view of the MDT log files. So every script writes to its own log file and writes the exact same entries to bdd.log. So if you wanted to just look at, say, what did it do for driver injection, ztidrivers.log will tell you that. But if you want to see that plus everything else around it, bdd.log will show you the complete set of log entries for all the scripts. So generally, if you have the bdd.log, you don't need all the other little ones. That will be able to show you all the different pieces. There are some additional logs, though, that the scripts will create that may be useful for troubleshooting. We've been working on getting all of those renamed so that it's obvious what they correspond to. For example, if you're doing a backup, ZTI backup is the script that runs that. It runs ImageX to actually create the backup WIM. Well, we create ZTI backup underscore ImageX.log by redirecting the output of ImageX so that we can see that later. So maybe you get an error back in the bdd.log that says ImageX.exe failed with return code 2. Well, now you need to look at the ZTI backup ImageX.log file to see, well, what error did ImageX log in there that would explain the error code 2? In the config manager case, other logs that might be of interest, drivercatalog.log is on the server side. It contains information about drivers that you're importing into config manager. If you get any errors during the import process, look at that one. It'll tell you what's going on. TaskSequenceProvider.log is used when importing or saving a task sequence. So if you get an error when you click OK or when you're trying to do the import, that one will hopefully give you some clues as to what's going on there. The most common issue that you have when saving a task sequence happens when it gets too big. So let's say that you've gone through and you've been adding step after step after step into your config manager task sequence, maybe for driver packages. You now have a couple hundred of them in your task sequence with conditions applied to them. That keeps making the task sequence XML blob bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually, it exceeds the WMI buffer size necessary to save that back to the config manager server. It causes a failure when you click OK. Not too hard to fix. You can go through the process of updating the WMI server configuration to say, please allocate more memory so that we can have a bigger XML blob. But that's a manual step that you would have to go through when you get to that point. There are other challenges with that, too, with the policies and everything else that goes along with having all of those different steps and packages referenced in there, but that's a completely different discussion. Getting to the logs then becomes the next challenge. So the first point that you would really want to start digging in is when the error message is still up on the screen. In the case of a config manager failure, it will show an error dialog and start a countdown. That countdown, I think, starts at 15 minutes by default and counts down to zero. When it gets to zero, it cleans up all the logs and destroys any evidence that you might have been able to grab about the particular failure. So in a lot of cases, pressing F8 opens a command prompt. It prevents that cleanup from actually happening and lets you look around longer. So that's good. Plus, it lets you get to the logs in situations where you couldn't otherwise. So if a failure occurs when you're in Windows PE, it's not like you can open up Explorer and go to the C drive and see what log files are there. You had to press F8 to get a command prompt and then navigate from the command prompt to try to figure out where these log files are. So F8 is a good keystroke to know. In the config manager case, that's something you had to turn on. There's a checkbox on each of the boot images. You had to check it to say to enable it. It's not enabled by default. We did add an option in the MDT wizards for config manager when you're creating a new boot image in MDT 2012 that says enable F8, and it's checked by default. So if you're using MDT to create boot images, we'll always check the F8 box. The config manager guys don't check it by default, though, because they say it's a security issue. Okay, in Windows PE, someone can press F8, get a command prompt, and mess around with what's on the hard drive. I don't care. I would rather be able to troubleshoot. So security by ignorance, who would know that you could press F8 at that point anyway? Light touch, same thing, although in the light touch case, F8's enabled by default. So anytime you press F8, you get a command prompt. If you really are security conscious and want to turn that off, you can edit one of the MDT files to say that you don't want F8 support, and it'll suppress that. There is another point in the process where Windows setup is running. In that case, MDT and Config Manager aren't around, so the F8 key won't work. You may need to hit Shift F10 in that situation. It's a keystroke that's been around since probably Windows NT 3.5. Still there today, works by default. There are some registry keys that you could use to turn that off, but I don't know of anyone outside of government agencies that have ever done that. So generally, if setup is running, you can press Shift F10 to get a command prompt. Okay, log files. We've talked enough about what they all are. Now let's start to look at some common issues, starting first with Windows 7. It's possible that you could do an installation and you see setup begin to run in Config Manager, in Light Touch, doesn't really matter, where you get an error back saying that Windows could not parse or process unattend answer file, unattend.xml for patch specialized. The answer file is invalid. So it knows that something in the unattend isn't right. But it's not going to tell you what isn't right. It's going to make you get into the log file and figure that out yourself. So the symptoms that you would see, like in bdd.log for a light touch deployment, you'll see that setup.exe failed, return code 31. Return code 31, as you'll figure out, means that it didn't like something in the unattend.xml. So at that point, we need to get into the setup.act.log or the setup.error.log and figure out what didn't it like. What you'll see in there is something along the lines of SMI data results dump source equals blah, setting computer name, description, value is invalid. So it's not the most easy thing to decipher, but at least it now clearly indicates to you that, hey, the setting I don't like is the computer name. So I specified an invalid computer name. A reason that you could run into something like that is if you put in a computer name that's longer than 15 characters, that's the maximum. You could have other special characters in the computer name that aren't valid. Whatever the situation is, that's the type of error that it would log as a result. So let's look at what that kind of manifests itself as. So I went to try some of these this morning and found that the behavior has changed a little bit. For this one, it's still consistent, but it's not happening at the same point in time that it used to. So like in the case of MDT 2010 Update 1, when we installed Windows 7, we would do it by running setup.exe from within Windows PE, and setup would take care of installing the OS. I'm running MDT 2012 Update 1 pre-beta bits, and in those bits, we don't run setup anymore. We just apply the image to the hard drive, service it, put the unattend in place, and reboot ourselves. That means setup doesn't have a chance to validate the unattend.xml and complain about it up front. It now means we've installed the OS, we've rebooted into the OS, and when the OS booted up for the first time, now it has a chance to complain and say, I don't like this unattend. Of course, at this point, there's not a whole lot you can do about it except figure out how it happened. So we can see the error. Pressing F8 won't do anything here because Config Manager's not around, so I can hit Shift F10 to open up a command prompt. If I look at the root of the drive, there's no $Windows-BT folder, so we know it got farther in the process than that. So let's look next in Windows Panther. We can see setup act.log, setup error.log from 3:52 a.m. That's Pacific time. I wasn't actually up at 3:52 a.m. Oops. And if we look in the unattend GC folder, there we can see setup act.log, setup error.log, but those are actually from the previous day at 9:13 p.m. So, all right, it's not those. So that means we want to focus on the ones that are here. Since the error log actually has something in it, we can start at that point and see, well, maybe this is enough to tell us what's really going on. In some cases, it may be. In other cases, it just gives you an idea of where you want to look in the context of the larger setup act.log. But in this case, it's actually fairly useful to show you that the Microsoft Windows Shell setup section of the unattend.xml contains an invalid value. If we scroll to the end of that line, we can see it's the setting for computer name. Okay, so let's close that out. Now the unattend.xml itself is in this same folder, so we can open that up in Notepad. Find computer name and see that, yep, that's definitely longer than 15 characters. So it doesn't like that computer name. Well, then the question becomes, well, how did that long computer name get in there? That's the type of thing that you may do accidentally. In this case, I have MDT configured, telling it that when I install that computer with that particular MAC address in this case, I want to set... Now what did I do? I want to set OSD computer name to the serial number of the machine. In the case of a virtual machine, the serial number is a GUID. That's too long. So maybe instead I would want to do something like OSD computer name equals # left serial number, comma 15. And then I wouldn't have that problem. So it's fairly easy to do something like that. That's not the only error that you would see for an invalid entry in the unattend. It'll always start off with the same symptoms. It'll always say error equals 31 or didn't like something in a particular phase in a particular component. You'll have to get into the log to see which component, which exact issue is it running into. You can also have challenges related to product keys. This is another one of those situations where when you're running setup, setup validates values that you specify for the product key. When you're not running setup, it doesn't validate it until later in the process. So if you're using MDT 2010 and it installs the OS and you put in the wrong product key, you're going to get back an error that says something like, there were no images available. Well, there were obviously images available because you're running a task sequence that points to a WIM file that contains an image. You specifically specified when you created the task sequence, here's the image that I want to install. So why is it saying that there are no images? What it really means is I saw the image, I know what SKU that image was. I saw the product key, I know what SKU that was. I used the product key to filter the image list. I filtered all the images from the list and was left with no results. So rather than just telling you the product key you specified didn't match the image you specified, it goes through some wacky logic of saying here are all the possible SKUs, here are all the possible images. After I look at the product key, there are none. So process fails. To figure that one out gets kind of interesting because you have to dig through the log files and see where does it read the product key and how does it verify the product key. So it'll log an entry in the log that says the edition ID for the product key is, say, professional. So I'm deploying Windows 7 Enterprise. Well, why is it logging that the product key that I specified was for Windows 7 Professional? There's the problem. if you put in a professional key and you're deploying enterprise, if you put in an enterprise key and you're deploying professional, you're going to run into this type of issue. So I went to try to reproduce this one with MDT 2012 this morning, where I specified I want to deploy the OS, and I want it to have a specific product key. And in this case, I deployed Windows 8 and specified a Windows 8 product key for Windows 8 Pro, even though I was deploying I was deploying Windows 8 Release Preview, and I specified a product key for Windows 8 Enterprise. So I expected a failure. Instead, here's what I got. I got a fully installed, fully functional operating system. Okay, so what happened in that case? I see that in the unattendGC folder, there was a log that was created this morning. And in that log, it has a single entry that says it failed to install the product key. Okay, so setup found the product key that I specified. It tried to install it into the OS, said it couldn't, and just moved on. So what does that mean? I now have an operating system with no product key. Not a big deal for the first 30 days. You better give it a valid product key within the next 30 days, or it's going to start nagging you to say, you really, really, really need to put in a product key now. It won't ever go into reduced functionality mode anymore, but it will get more and more persistent about asking you about that. It'll get rid of the screen background, it'll turn black, it'll start prompting all the time, but it will continue to work fine. So this is one of those hidden failures now where you won't actually see the fact that you specified the wrong product key. If you're deploying Windows 7 or Windows 8 or even Windows Vista, and you're using volume license media, which most of you should be, you really never need to specify a product key if you're using KMS activation. If you're using Mac activation, you specify a Mac key, but if you're doing KMS activation, yeah, just leave it blank. So you can cause yourself more grief by specifying a product key than if you just leave it off. Next issue. There was a problem initially where people were deploying Windows Vista. Still happened somewhat in Windows 7, but they changed some things in Windows 7 to make this harder. In the case of Windows Vista, a lot of people for Windows XP had a deployment process that would prompt for a computer name during mini setup, but then specified a sysprep.inf that specified domain join details. So the idea was prompt for the computer name and then join the computer name that you just specified into the domain that was in the answer file. So they would get Windows Vista. The first thing they would try is the exact same process. Let me configure the unattend to prompt for the computer name, but specify domain join details. Seems reasonable. Doesn't work. Because the domain join would happen first during the specialized phase, and then the new computer name would be applied later during UBI. So as a result, it would join with the randomly generated mini-NT whatever name and then rename the computer later, which would break the domain join because it didn't update the AD account when it renamed the computer later. They decided that was by design. Okay, it's an awfully inconvenient design, but that's fine. It didn't cause issues for MDT, it didn't cause issues for Config Manager, it didn't cause issues for most OS deployment solutions out there because they didn't do it that way. But if you had a home-built solution that did it that way, you weren't happy about this. So we thought, okay, Windows 7 is going to come around, they're going to fix this. Yeah, they fixed it. They got rid of the computer name prompt. So now there's no way you can get Windows 7 to prompt for a computer name, and as a result, this problem will never happen. That's the solution, but it now means that unless you had the right computer name in the unattend.xml, it's going to always join with a random computer name. So again, you're back to using something like MDT, something like Config Manager that can inject a correct computer name into the unattend.xml before the specialized phase so that the computer name is set and the domain are joined at the same time. Easy enough to do. If you still don't want to use those tools or you run into a product that has this problem still, I would think several years later they should have taken care of this by now. The other solution that you can do is just say, I'm going to not join the domain during the unattend. I'm going to wait until the new OS is up and running and then use netdom or a PowerShell script or a VB script or something to join the domain after the OS is up and running. So it has its final computer name already, and then you just tell it to join the domain. My comment in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen is kind of going back to my mainframe days. IBM mainframes have a bug database that everyone in the world who's using IBM mainframes can see. And when you submit a bug, they will resolve it, and you'll be able to see the status. Typical mainframe style, all the statuses were three-character acronyms. And they had an acronym called BAD, B-A-D, which stood for broken as designed. So they had a way of saying, yes, it's by design, but our design is broken, which means we should fix it. Microsoft has no such status. So if they resolve a bug as by design, that probably means they will never fix it. You'll see that frequently. Another issue that you might run into is the domain join fails, and you have to figure out why. That's where that netsetup.log comes in. And the number one failure that we tend to see is the one described on the screen. Unattended join, net join domain failed, error codes 1355. That's kind of misleading because if you look up that error number, it means invalid domain. That's not the case. I specified a valid domain. Well, the problem in this case is I specified an invalid OU. So I specified a domain object OU in my unattend file that said CN equals computers. CN equals computers isn't an OU. It's a container. You can't specify a container. You can only specify an OU. It's another one of those bizarre restrictions in Windows, but the intention is if you want it to join the computer's container, you leave the parameter blank, and then it will go into the computer's container, or if you have a policy applied to your domain, it'll go into whatever default container you specified in AD. So, in this case, if we look at what happens in a deployment where I specify that, find another VM here. This is one of those cases where MDT, doing a light touch deployment, is trying to do you a favor, but doesn't realize that it actually just made the problem a little bit worse. It tried to join the domain initially from the unattend. It saw, once it got into the new OS, that the domain join failed. So what did it do? It tried the join again. It failed again, so it rebooted the computer. Tried the join again. It failed. Reboot the computer. Tried the join again. Failed. Reboot the computer. Fortunately, there's a limit in that script that says if we've done that more than four times, stop, because it's pointless to keep trying to join the domain because it's never going to work. So, okay, we can see that's what happened. It tried to join the domain too many times, count equals to four, so we can click finish, allow the shell to come up, and then try to find in the netsetup.log what exactly happened. Oh, and I had to activate Windows because I had an invalid product key in there. Which is fun because I don't know that I can necessarily get out of that screen. I had that problem yesterday. There's always a way. So let me navigate to the Windows debug folder. In there I can see the netsetup.log. It's another one of those kind of hard to follow logs, but in this case if we look for CN equals computer, we can see that that's definitely the parameter that was specified to join the domain. So it's telling us the machine object OU is that value. There's too many scroll bars here. And it's scrolling along. It's trying to find the object. Here's the error message. Specified path is not an OU. So that's the only real indication this is why the domain join is failing. If you keep scrolling down, eventually it generates an error 1355 in hex, which I always forget what the hex value is, but you won't really see anything else of interest or of use in this log file. You'll just see the message that says, oh, by the way, this is a container. Doesn't clearly say that's an error. It just says that's a container. So don't specify a container. In the case of MDT, if you go through the Lightouch wizard and try to type in an OU, it won't let you type anything that starts with CN equals. It considers that a problem because we know it won't work. In the Config Manager case, though, if we were to go to the site server in the console, I haven't tried this on CM12. We'll see if it's any smarter than CM07 was. If we find the task sequence, edit that task sequence, find the apply network setting step, which is where the domain join details are, specify a domain, click to browse the domain OU, choose computers, it will happily put in CN equals computers. So now if you were ever to deploy this, the join's going to fail. So we filed the bugs to filter that out. They just have postponed it a couple of times. So don't do that. It won't work. Okay. Another common issue is that you try to join the domain and specify an OU. The domain join works fine, but it leaves the computer in whatever OU it was in before. How many of you have ever noticed that? Most of you in the room, because it's been like that for ages. Another one of these cases of it's by design, which probably means the behavior is never going to change. It's just a standard way that Windows will, instead of moving the computer to the new OU, it will always just update the existing computer object in place. That may cause some issues, especially as you're moving from one OS to the other, if you have group policies that are OS specific. So in those situations, you may want to consider either trying to put something into your deployment process that moves the computer to the right container at the right time, which is very timing dependent, or if you can't guarantee that, at least put some WMI filters on your GPOs to make sure that the wrong ones don't apply to the new OS, because that could cause some damage. That also means that there are some potential security gotchas. If you specify a domain join account that only has permissions to join a computer into the container that you specified, if it only has permissions to create a computer object in the container you specified, it's not going to be able to update an existing computer in a different container. You would need to give it modify rights to all of the existing computer accounts so that it could update those existing computer accounts with a new computer password. So make sure that your join account is configured appropriately. Using low rights accounts is great. Limit them as much as you can, but you need to make sure that you cover both cases. As long as you're only creating new accounts, you can give it very few rights, but if you need to update existing accounts, that probably means it needs broad modify rights to all your computer objects. Crashes are those wonderful things that you hope to not have to actually troubleshoot. They happen, but the hope is that when you see them, you know what the cause is without even troubleshooting. So if you see a stop 7B, you know you're missing a mass storage driver. You don't really need to get a dump out of the machine and figure out, well, what driver was it trying to load or anything like that. You just know I need to find the right mass storage driver for this computer and get it added into my image. Unfortunately, after that nice simple stop B, stop 7B, they get harder and harder to figure out. Another common one that we saw prior to MDT 2010 Update 1 was a status 0XC0000359, which sort of looks like a stop screen, but it's not quite a stop screen, but it has the same result. The OS reboots itself. That one would happen if you installed an x64 driver on an x86 OS or the other way around. So Windows would inject the driver like it was told. It would try to start it up. It would say, nope, that's for the wrong platform. That's what would cause that crash. So after we analyzed enough of those, we figured that that was happening because MDT would import drivers from the vendors. Those drivers would have INF files that indicated what platforms they supported. We believed those INF files. So if the INF file said this driver supports x86 and x64, okay, we will inject this driver on x86 and x64 as appropriate. What we found, though, was they would have one INF file that would point to the same files for x86 and x64. Well, obviously, the same file can't be x86 and x64. It can be one or the other. So what they would do is they would ship the same INF in both driver packages, one with the DLLs and sys files and the other ones being x86, and in the other package, they'd all be x64. So we added logic in Update 1 that would actually look at all the files referenced by the INF, inspect them to see what platform they were. If the INF said x86 and x64 and all we could find were x86 files, this isn't an x64 driver. We would automatically uncheck that platform, so we would never try to inject it on an x64 OS. So that got rid of most of these driver-related crashes where we would inject the wrong driver on the wrong platform. For any other type of stop error, generally you need to get a dump to troubleshoot it. The problem with that is dumps are turned off by default on Windows 7. Or at minimum, you probably get a mini dump, but generally the support people are going to want to see a full dump. So there is a registry key that you would need to adjust to get a full dump out of it. There's also an auto reboot setting so that it reboots automatically after the blue screen occurs. So unless your eyesight is extremely good, you're not going to be able to see the stop message before it disappears. So if you're running into these types of problems, you can put this auto reboot equals zero parameter into your image and then do the deployment, and as a result, it will stay on the stop screen until you power the computer off. I think with Windows 8, they've finally put some more reasonable logic in that says in Windows 8, when you get a stop error, it will display the stop screen for a short period of time, like around a minute, and then it'll reboot. If you haven't yet seen the Windows 8 stop screen, it has a frowning face on the top left corner. It's still a blue screen, but it's not the same blue screen as what we saw before. Okay, setup failures. I think we've already gone through all of these, so let's then talk about Windows PE. The biggest challenge, the biggest problem that you'll run into with Windows PE is making sure that it has networking. It needs network drivers to connect to your deployment chair. That's easy enough. But the real question then is how to troubleshoot the different issues, the different scenarios that you might see. Like if you look at the screen prints that are on this slide, do you know what the difference is between the first one and the second one? In the first case, we typed ipconfig, we got Windows IP configuration header, and nothing underneath it. What does that mean? It means there are no drivers installed for any network adapters. That could mean there are no network adapters, which would be a problem, or you don't have the drivers for the network adapters that are in the machine, you need to add drivers. The second one is much more obvious. You type ipconfig, it comes back and says local area connection media disconnected. Okay, it found a driver for an Ethernet adapter. It installed it, but it's saying that there's no media attached. That's a simple problem to fix, plug in the cable. So that's not a common one that you're going to run into very much, but then you start running it in situations where you type ipconfig, you see the adapter, you see a 169 address. Oh, okay, it's not getting a DHCP lease. Now I need to figure out why is it not getting a DHCP lease. So it's all about walking through that troubleshooting process methodically to figure out what's not working. We've seen people who've had issues where when it would boot into a full OS, it would get a DHCP lease without any problem. When it would boot into Windows PE, it wouldn't. Well, okay, that generally is caused by switch configuration settings, especially if you have Cisco switches that aren't configured with spanning tree port fast. Talk to your network guys. Tell them we would like to try this with the switch port that's configured for spanning tree port fast. When the OS boots up, it goes through a negotiation process with the switch to decide what speed and duplex it's supposed to use. With that not enabled, that negotiation process can take anywhere from 10 to 30 seconds. Windows PE isn't very patient, waiting for the DHCP lease to be obtained. It doesn't know that there's still a speed duplex negotiation going on with the switch, so it gives up and gives a locally administered address. There's no way to adjust that timeout in Windows PE, so you have to make the switch respond faster. A potential troubleshooting tip for that one is connect the PC to a $15 Best Buy hub and then connect the hub to the switch. If the problem goes away, the problem's the switch. When you're connected to a dumb hub like that, the negotiation process doesn't happen between the computer and the hub. So the computer gets a connection right away. The negotiation happens between the hub and the switch. So the hub is on all the time, so it goes through that negotiation once when you first plug it in. So when the computer then powers up, boots into PE, it's able to get a DHCP lease back immediately. You can also have name resolution issues where you get a DHCP address. You can see that in the list, but if you try to ping the server name, you can't. MDT has logic in it that will continue to retry. If we see that we've got a 169 address, we'll do a DHCP release and renew, just trying to get an IP address back. If we see any type of network error when we're trying to connect, we'll try again with longer and longer waits in between each try. So we're doing our best to make sure that we can reliably make a connection. But if the name resolution isn't set up right, that's never going to do any good. Eventually, it's going to come back with an error saying that we couldn't connect to the deployment share. Generally, if you're doing DNS name resolution, it should work just as well in the full OS as it works in Windows PE, unless you are using group policy to push out DNS suffixes and then specifying unsuffixed names to MDT. When you're in Windows PE, it's not going to receive any group policies. So as a result, it's not going to get the DNS suffixes, so it may not be able to resolve the name using the DNS suffix that it received from DHCP. So, okay, you need to learn how to use NSLookup, you need to know how to use ping, you need to be able to verify that you have name resolution from within Windows PE to the server. It's not too hard, but just something that you'll need to go through. In the case of MDT, a common scenario that we saw was that people would build a custom WIM image, build it, capture it, import it into MDT, create a task sequence, deploy it. They said it deploys just fine, but it automatically logs in but doesn't resume the task sequence. Why not? So we've investigated several of these where they've sent us their images, we've looked at them, and we found out they weren't sysprepped. So why didn't you sysprep it? Well, we read a blog article from Mark Rasinovich that said it's not required to run sysprep. Okay, that's not entirely true. It's not required to run sysprep to deal with SID duplicates. It is required to run sysprep before you mass produce an operating system and deploy it to multiple machines. So there is a Deployment Guys blog out there that goes into greater detail on that, but there's the challenge that you need to sysprep it so that the OS knows to go through this specialization process, to go through the processing of all the settings that we specified to run the new OS. It's also surprisingly common to run, to do a manual sysprep that doesn't work. And in a lot of cases, you run sysprep with /quiet/shutdown or some command line switches that cause you to never see the fact that it failed, especially problematic on XP. You run sysprep /mini/quiet/whatever, and you think that the process ran through okay. You saw the dialog come up on the screen showing that it was processing. It took 15 or 20 minutes, and then the dialog went away. Must have succeeded. No. So if you were to do a sysprep and capture task sequence in MDT, or just a normal build and capture task sequence, we have an additional check in the task sequence that looks at the registry to see if the final thing that sysprep does, it writes a clone tag registry key. That clone tag registry key must be present to indicate that sysprep succeeded. So people are running sysprep manually. They're not verifying that the clone tag entry is there, which means sysprep failed. They don't detect the failure. Some people running MDT are seeing this error coming back from MDT saying that sysprep failed, the clone tag registry key is not present. They say, that's a problem with MDT. No, that's a problem with sysprep running on against your image. And in most cases, sysprep fails because of the mass storage drivers that are hooked into the sysprep.inf that you're using when you're sysprepping. So it probably means you have a problem with one of those mass storage drivers. Either it's not valid, the files are missing, or it can't be injected, whatever the issue is. So the process is failing because of something like that. Instead, they modify the MDT scripts to bypass the error and then run into an error farther down the line when they then deploy that and the task sequence doesn't resume when it's in the new OS. So don't ignore those failures. They're particularly bad because they're silent and you don't really know that they're happening. It's one of the best things with Windows 7, Windows 8. The sysprep process now finally writes a log file. Sysprep on Windows XP was a black box. If it failed, you had no idea why it failed. All you could do is modify your sysprep.inf. The first troubleshooting tips usually take out the entire sysprep mass storage section. Now try to run sysprep. Does it work? If it works, okay, build your image again and put back half of the drivers. Did it work? Okay, now put back half of the rest. So you're really just trying to pare it down to find out which of the 5,000 lines that you've added into that file for the mass storage drivers you need to support, because there's one line for each plug-and-play ID, which line is causing the issues. It's just a nightmare to go through that process. Fortunately, Windows 7 makes that easy. Another challenge that we ran into frequently is that people would do a deployment with MDT Light Touch, and it wouldn't complete for one reason or another, leaving behind files that interfered with the next one. So they would do, maybe they'd power it off, maybe it would blue screen, whatever the problem was. They'd try to then initiate a new bare metal deployment, and it would try to pick up the previous task sequence from where it left off. So we added logic into MDT to avoid that by being able to detect a dirty state. So we'll throw up a dialog that says an existing in-progress deployment was found, but it's not in an expected state. Would you like to ignore it and start a new one? Generally, the answer is always going to be yes, unless you really know what you're doing. So I've got a machine over here. So I started a task sequence on this computer, and when it got about halfway through, I hit the power button and turned it off. Booted it back up again, hit F12 to pixie boot it, and when it came back in, I got this error message. So this is what it's telling me. It's telling me that the environment is dirty. Do you really want to continue? The default is going to be yes, and that's what we would always recommend. If you really want to try to resume it, you can click no, but the odds of it working are fairly low. One of the challenges that we found with that is that people started seeing this during their normal task sequences. So they had a task sequence in MDT 2010 that was working just fine. They upgraded to MDT 2012. Now after the first reboot, when they're installing applications, they would see this message pop up on the screen. Must be a problem with MDT. Well, it's a problem caused by the changes in MDT, but it's actually a problem with your task sequence. Your task sequence is running a command, and that command initiated a reboot of the computer and ripped the task sequence out from under us. So we have no idea how the task sequence stopped. We have no idea how the computer restarted. All we know is we're coming back into it again, and we don't know what happened. So we put up the dialogue. And in that case, yeah, it would work to say, no, continue the existing task sequence, but that's awfully inconvenient because each app that does that, you're going to have to click no afterwards to tell it to keep on going. Almost always, like 99% of the ones that we've looked at so far, that's been caused by an Adobe Acrobat Reader install where they didn't specify to suppress the restart. Apparently, you had to specify two different command lines on the Adobe Reader installation to say no restart, like slash no restart, and then you had to put in reboot equals really suppress. Why you need two different ones, I have no idea, but if you put them both in, it doesn't restart, then it won't prompt because of the dirty environment. You can also run into errors when MDT can't find setup. The good thing is this one no longer happens with MDT 2012 because we've added in fallback logic that says if we can't find setup, let's just use ImageX. But the issue that we had in MDT 2010 was that we always use setup to install the OS. So when you would import your original source files for the OS, you would have a copy of setup with that. When you would import your custom WIM, you wouldn't. That would be okay with one deployment share because we would look through all the other OSs trying to find a copy of setup that had the same version as your custom image, and we would use that instead automatically. But now if you created another deployment share and it only had your custom WIM in it without any setup files, we wouldn't be able to find any other setup files to use and would display the error saying that we were unable to find setup needed to install the image. It would happen with media, it would happen with linked deployment shares. We had notes in the docs that would say, this could happen, here's why, here's how to solve it. It was in the troubleshooting docs, it was in the release notes, it was in at least four different places in the docs, and still it was the number one cause of support calls. So that's why we said, okay, for 2012, we're going to put in the fallback logic. In 2012 update one, we will never use setup, so you'll never run into these types of issues because we're just tired of setup at this point. Task sequence failures, the most common message that you end up seeing is this -214.746.7259 error, which if you look it up actually means an error occurred. So you have to figure out what that error was, and it could be caused by any number of things. So this is one of those cases where you need to dig through the smsts.log using Trace32 or similar tools to help look up those errors. If we look on the server side, there is some help for that. Like I have a config manager installed on this server, and the config manager 2012 installation folder is Program Files Microsoft Configuration Manager. They include cmtrace in there, so if we do a directory of cmtrace, we can see the 32-bit version of it is there, the 64-bit version of it's there, and then they have another copy of it in tools. So those are the ones you would want to grab. In this case, I've put a shortcut on the top of my start menu because I do this all the time to open that up. And if we use that to look at these log files, I like to look at bdd.log. If there are errors, they end up getting highlighted in red. So it makes it really easy at a glance to see, oh, there's the error. But in this case, the error is either the number here or the same value in hex. We can copy that, say error lookup, paste, unspecified error. Well, that's not useful. That's kind of where we started with this. So that can be helpful, using that tool to look at the logs and then also using it to help look up those messages. The challenge that you'll run into sometimes is that the task sequencer especially assumes that if there's an error number, that that error number must be a Windows error. Let me ask Windows to translate it to text, which is the same as what would happen if you typed net help message and then an error number. So net help message 5 means access denied. In this case, people will look at this and see that it ends with 005 and think, oh, it must be a security error. No. Only if it starts with 8007 and is then exactly 0005, then it's a security error. But if it's 8000, that's a different facility, and the 4005 is definitely not security related. So don't get thrown off by that one. You can also run into issues on MDT trying to generate a catalog. The biggest problem here is you can't generate a catalog for an x86 OS when you want to use Windows System Image Manager to edit an unattend from an x64 OS. You have to generate the catalog on an x86 OS. Once it's generated, you can then edit it on an x64 OS. That's true today with Windows AIK. That'll continue to be true with Windows ADK. In the Config Manager case, you can still see those same 8000-4005 messages, same basic reasoning. You'll have to search through the logs to figure out what's going on. If you see Windows running from D:\Windows, that means that you imported your install.wim into Config Manager and used it as an image package and deployed a task sequence using that. If you're using the original install.wim, you need to import it as an install package so that it runs setup. Setup will install it and change the drive letter, and then it'll work okay. The weird thing about this is Windows actually fixed this in Windows 7, and it's no longer necessary for Config Manager to force the drive letter to D, but it doesn't know that, so it still ends up as D. That's why MDT LightTouch can get away with using the image directly, whereas Config Manager still runs into this issue. You can run into hash mismatch errors. They seem to happen randomly, fairly easy. Refresh the DPs to avoid that. The biggest learning there is if you're going to deploy 200 machines, test one first. Because you don't want to get 200 machines into Windows PE and then find out the operating system package is missing. There are a lot of people that will frantically call up CSS and say, help, we have 200 machines that now won't boot. Okay, well, you're going to have to fix them one at a time. And here's the process to go through. It's very tedious. If you would have tried one first, you would have seen the hash mismatch failure on the first one. You would have fixed that, and then you can deploy the other 199. Packages not available. It's been a common situation. Same basic problem. At least this time, it would verify it up front and give you an error saying that it couldn't find all the packages necessary to run this task sequence. So in CM07, it was kind of tedious to go through each of those packages and then distribute it to each of the distribution points. So I had posted a PowerShell script that showed you how to, just run the PowerShell script. It would look at every task sequence, every package referenced by that task sequence, every distribution point for those packages, and distribute those packages anywhere it was missing. So it could take care of that. Now with CM12, they've added in a new distribute content wizard. So if you right-click on a task sequence and say distribute content, it will identify all the packages. You can then say I want to distribute it to a distribution point group or a distribution point. It'll then filter that, and it'll only show you ones where it's missing. So it will know that in the case of one of my task sequences, if I went in and tried to tell it to distribute content, it would tell me that there are no distribution points where this content isn't already on it. So it's fairly easy with CM12 to get the content distributed and verified. But with CM07, you may want to look at the PowerShell script on my blog. Pixie boot can always be a challenge to troubleshoot. We could spend a day just talking about Pixie boot troubleshooting, so we'll skip over that one for right now. The basic thing is that you really need to pay attention to the different symptoms. Is it failing because it's not getting to the server? Is it getting to the server, but the server's not responding? Is the server responding, but responding with abort pixie? Those are all different variations that you need to identify what's happening there. We'll look at one simple case here, because I'm running out of time, where I have a machine here. It's in an OS, but I don't really care about the OS, so let me reset that one. Let me hit F12. And now we see it contacting the server. It got back a response from the server. Now it's waiting for something else from the server, and it's just going to sit there forever. So, okay, normally if you're using WDS standalone, you'd never see something like this unless it was set up for approval. In the Config Manager case, though, this probably means that Config Manager is trying to do something. So if we switch over to the server and open up the SMS pixie.log, maybe we can see what it's up to. It wants boot image PRI00013, and it's not there, so then it's not responding to the client. So that's good, it got the packet, but it couldn't find the boot image that it wanted to send down to the machine. Well, why couldn't it find the boot image? Well, then we can troubleshoot, we can find that boot image, which was 1.3. If we open up the properties in CM12 now to distribute a boot image, it is just a checkbox. And I always forget where that checkbox is, so I end up just clicking until I find it. Not there. There it is. Deploy this boot image from the Pixie-enabled distribution point. If I click that, click Apply, it'll then distribute the boot image to the Pixie distribution point, and then it'll be able to reply successfully to the client. So a fairly easy problem to fix. It's just not obvious that that's the symptom of a missing boot image, because it would just sit there until it timed out. So checking the smspixie.log, the wdsserver.log, those are going to be useful. There are some cache expiration times that you might want to look into, because once it's answered back, I don't want to Pixie boot you, it remembers that answer for a period of time. Until it forgets, it doesn't matter what you've changed on the server side, it's not going to give a different answer. So there are some blog entries out there from the Config Manager CSS support people that are useful to try to walk more methodically through this, but yeah, that could be a very long process. As far as troubleshooting, there are ways, like if you were to cancel out of a task sequence in Windows PE, you can resume it just by running xdeploy script slighttouch.wsf from within Windows PE. For testing applications, you can create a task sequence that contains a single step that says install applications, which works really well with virtual machines that have snapshots. You can run the task sequence, try to install your apps, roll it back, run the task sequence again. Rather than going through a full 2-hour or hour-long deployment, you can just quickly cycle through a single-step task sequence to do that. It's also possible to run ZTI gather manually from the command line to test out your custom settings.ini rule. So it's all about trying to do some things to troubleshoot before you even run your full task sequence to make sure that the whole end-to-end process works okay. Since we're out of time, I'll skip through that and just summarize. If you still have any issues that you just can't figure out, you can always contact Microsoft support. They'll always ask for logs. Make sure you have them ready. You can always use the MDT and Config Manager OSD forums on the TechNet page. And there's also a fairly active mailing list hosted by myitforum.com, the MDT OSD mailing list that's entirely about OS deployment. Most of it involves MDT and OSD, but as far as OS deployment issues go, anything's fair game. There are lots of people that will reply back offering suggestions and tips and will say, well, email me your logs and we'll see if we can figure out. So it's a very active community that'll help you out. So check those out and hopefully they'll be some help to you. Hopefully this was some help to you. The deck should be available. You can look at it again later. My goal as I move forward is to try to turn this into a document, a book, because this could easily turn into, say, a couple of hundred pages of documentation. Longer term, that's what we would like to do, is try to get more of this down on paper so that I don't have to keep talking about this over and over again. But hopefully it was useful. Fill out your evaluations, and thanks for attending.